Hello, and thank you for joining us today. I'm Courtney Keating, the Director of Environmental, Social, and Governance Research at Glass Lewis. And today we're going to be discussing a number of climate change-related shareholder proposals that either went to a vote in 2017 or that are going to a vote in the coming proxy season. Climate change has been at the forefront of many investors' minds in recent years, and accordingly, we've seen a fairly significant uptick in the number of shareholder resolutions requesting increased disclosure on how companies are handling the risks associated with this issue. 2017 was really a watershed year for this issue, particularly with respect to shareholder proposals. We saw not only a record number of climate change-related proposals, but record support for these resolutions. In fact, three of those proposals at ExxonMobil, PPL, and Occidental Petroleum received majority shareholder support in the last year. All of this is happening against a very interesting political and regulatory backdrop. I think it's fairly notable that the majority supported Exxon vote came the day before Donald Trump announced that the U.S. would be withdrawing from the Paris Agreement. However, other countries and regulatory bodies have been a lot more progressive with respect to climate change in the last year. One of the most notable developments, in my opinion, has been the creation of the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosure, or the TCFD, which we'll talk about a little bit more on this call. Mark Carney, the chair of the Financial Stability Board and the governor of the Bank of England, announced the establishment of the TCFD at the end of 2015. And in two short years, this reporting framework has really become the gold standard in climate reporting. Although the final version of the TCFD recommendations was published in June of last year, a number of companies have been quick to adopt the recommended disclosures. This is part of a larger movement by companies who are trying to get ahead of this issue and who have begun producing enhanced climate disclosure. In the last year, this reporting has really begun to proliferate, and while there is really a relative dearth of comprehensive climate reporting at this time last year, we're seeing more and more companies produce reports concerning this issue, and a number of which follow or reference the recommendations of the TCFD. So given that so much has changed over the last year, we thought it would be helpful for our clients if we reassemble some of the people we spoke to last year about climate change resolutions. So joining us today to talk a little bit about more what's happened in the last year, what proposals are coming up in the 2018 proxy season, and how companies have responded to investor concerns regarding this issue, we have an all-star panel who are going to help us walk through this issue. With me, I have Ann Simpson, Investment Director of Sustainable Investing at the California Public Employees Retirement System, Patrick Doherty, the Director of Corporate Governance at the New York State Office of the State Comptroller, Helen Wildsmith, who's the Stewardship Director of the Climate Change at CCLA, and finally we have Edward Mason, who is the Head of Responsible Investment at the Church Commissioners of England. With that, I will turn it over to our speakers to give some introductory remarks and tell us a bit about what they're up to these days. Anne, I will turn it over to you.
Well, thank you very much to Glass Lewis for arranging this call. And thank you to all of those of you who've dialed in to listen and learn more about what's happening on proposals for shareholders to vote on climate change. I think the important shift that's taken place in the investor community is that we're not anymore talking about why we need to have improved reporting on climate change, both on risk and on opportunity. We're talking about how. In other words, I think a much broader consensus has developed that climate change can pose significant risk to companies. Through obvious impact to physical assets, with rising sea levels, for example, but also impact right through the value chain for the business. We're not just looking at one piece of that possible impact. So the question, not about how, about how, is really what these shareholder proposals are directed at. I think the other shift that we've seen, which is very important, is an acceptance by the global investor community that this type of reporting is part of fundamentally important reporting to ensure that we understand the risks in our portfolio and whether we're being rewarded for those risks, but also whether boards are gearing up to find the opportunities that climate change is presenting. And that's not just something that's going to have impact directly on the energy sector. There are many other sectors that are going to be affected as well. So markets need this information in order to put price on risk. And that also is going to be very important for investors as we engage companies on a wide range of issues, from how they structure incentives to the skills and experience that they have on their board, so-called climate competence, to understand these new challenges and these new opportunities. But also, I think, fundamentally, capital allocation. So, of course, these are all very big topics. They're things that long-term investors have front of mind when they're looking at their portfolio and engaging companies. But without a rigorous set of information in front of them, they're not in a position to really understand what's going on with an individual company, or to look across a sector, or even to look across different markets. So I think building on much of the work that's been going on in different regions in recent years, we've now seen investors, I think this is the third development, realizing that because this is a global issue, we need to have a global strategy. And we'll talk a little bit more on this call about the Climate Action 100 Plus. But that initiative is intended to bring together investors working in markets in North America, Europe, Asia, and also Australia and New Zealand, so that we can build a consensus around what we're asking companies to do in terms of reporting, and also really make sure that we're helping these companies focus on the long-term transition. And we'll come back to that. So, yeah, three developments. It's not why anymore, it's how. I think the acceptance of climate change as a risk and an opportunity in financial markets is now well established. And thirdly, I think we're seeing this proxy season, much greater exchange of information and cooperation between investors in different markets. So I think the strong support we have seen for these share owner proposals in the United States will probably strengthen this year. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Anne. Patrick, I'd love to turn it over to you to tell us a bit about what you've been up to over the last year and what you've got coming up in the coming proxy season.
Thanks very much. I appreciate Glass Lewis for having arranged this call. The passage of our resolution at Exxon's 2017 AGM by a more than 62% majority sent a shockwave throughout the industry, marking a monumental shift on climate disclosure among fossil fuel companies and their investors. It showed that investors will not wait for boards who fail to grasp the speed of the energy transition and are ready to go against board recommendations when companies fail to meet the new climate risk disclosure norm, which is 2-degree stress testing. The clear message is companies must respond to the Paris Agreement. The head in the sand days are over. The days of climate change denial are over. I'm in the northeast of the U.S. We've just had 4 nor'easters in as many weeks. Yesterday was the first day of spring, and when I woke up in the morning and opened my door, there was a foot of snow outside on the first day of spring. I mean, this can't be denied anymore. Companies and their boards are going to have to deal seriously with these issues, and we feel that these are potentially existential issues for many of the companies that we are engaged with. And we have very actively engaged in and are going to be continuing these initiatives. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Pat. So I thought we'd maybe hop across the pond and talk to Edward and see what you've been up to over the last year.
Yeah, thanks very much, Courtney. And it's great to be on this discussion again and to illustrate the level of transatlantic cooperation that we now have on climate change issues. I thought it might be helpful if I offered some observations and then just talked about our current priorities at the Church of England investing bodies. I mean, I'd very much agree with you, Courtney, that 2017 was a watershed year with contested climate change resolutions getting majority votes, not least at Exxon. And there have been developments since then that kind of, you know, further underline the depth of this trend, with the TCFD putting out its final report, Climate Action 100 Plus, as we've already heard and we'll discuss later on. I think, I mean, the key development that we saw at Exxon was the world's two largest asset managers voting for the resolution, so BlackRock and Vanguard. And since then, both of them have kind of stated their intent to make climate change and climate risk, climate disclosure, a very major priority for their engagement activities. So I'd very much underline the message that our expectation here is that the momentum from 2017 will continue. And we certainly see the risk profile of climate change growing year by year. 2017 saw global emissions increase for the first time in 3 years. They were up in 2017 on 2016. As you mentioned, Courtney, there's kind of policy uncertainty, still in different sort of speeds of development around the world. Technology continues to sort of progress faster than anyone had anticipated. In Europe, just in the past few days, we've had the first offshore wind farm given the go-ahead without subsidies. And we're seeing huge changes in sort of what car makers are forecasting in terms of electric vehicles, battery prices, and so on. So the atmosphere of great uncertainty, and I think, you know, we really expect the momentum for investors calling for climate disclosure to continue to increase. In terms of what we've been up to at the Church of England investing bodies, we work in partnership with the Church of England Pensions Board. I mean, our key priority over the past year has been the Transition Pathway Initiative, which is a partnership with the Environment Agency Pension Fund, and our research partners are the Grantham Research Institute of the London School of Economics. So this is an initiative to track the alignment of companies with the transition to a low-carbon economy, both their management quality on climate change and also the future carbon emissions expected for the business, and assessing how these align with both the 2 degrees target and also the nationally determined contributions of government. So this analysis looks at both kind of supply companies in terms of fossil fuel suppliers, but also heavy demand sectors like sort of autos, iron and steel, and so on. And all the information on that is available on the London School of Economics website, and it's very complementary to Climate Action 100 Plus in terms of analysing how companies are performing. And we'll be integrating this into our voting this year. Voting against directors where companies don't have the management quality on climate change that we would expect. So I think, I mean, this is another trend that I think we'll increasingly see is investors kind of using other votes besides kind of climate resolutions when they're presented to reflect their views on climate and the management of climate change as an issue. And then just one final thing is that the Church of England Pensions Board, our sister investing organisation, have co-filed a shareholder proposal at Rio Tinto Limited this year. And that's going to the Australian AGM at the beginning of May, the 2nd of May. And this is really a follow-up to the resolution that we saw at BHP Billiton last year on the company's sort of assessment of how trade association lobbying activities are consistent with the company's own position. So that's a sort of resolution from our perspective to watch out for this year.
Yeah, that's coming up soon. So thank you for the heads up there and for that update. And Helen, finally, I would like to turn it over to you to give some opening remarks.
Yes, of course, and thank you for bringing us all back together again. One of the things reflecting on the last few years is that, you know, we at CCLA hold about half a dozen companies across the Atlantic, Europe and the US. In the extractive and utilities sectors, as the others were saying, the demand side and the supply side. And we now have detailed standalone climate change reports from all of the companies that we hold, which I don't think we could have imagined, say, 5 years ago. And linked to that, one of the changes that we've made is that at the end of the last proxy season, we completed the merger of the Aiming for A initiative, which focused on initially about a dozen extractors and utilities companies listed in London. We finished the merger of that initiative into the European Institutional Investors Group on Climate Change, which is one of the five partners behind the Climate Action 100 Plus initiative. And I'm often asked if I think there will be a need for more resolutions like the enabling Aiming for A ones in Europe. And I think back to what Anne said, the principle of needing to report on your climate change risks and opportunities is now so embedded within the European context that I don't think we will need those sort of enabling resolutions, but perhaps occasionally a nudge to some of the laggards within the system.
Absolutely. And Helen, I'd actually like to stay with you to talk a bit about a bit more about the Aiming for A Coalition, which kind of arguably started this whole movement, of these types of proposals, and I think really allowed investors to start looking at this issue a bit differently. I'm wondering if you could, for those who don't know, give a quick rundown of your successes with Aiming for A, and a little bit about what you've been up to, what companies you've been talking to, and if you've had any more recent successes.
Yes, and really just to remind people that when we first formed the Aiming for A initiative back in 2011, we envisaged it as a decade-long stewardship program looking at climate risks and opportunities. And of course, it came into the headlines in 2015 with the shareholder resolutions at BP and Shell. And then the following year, very similar resolutions at some of the UK-listed mining companies. And we designed those resolutions to be looking at some of the themes that we've now seen picked up by the TCFD. So very much hoping that they would be voted through and therefore would become part of the reporting framework for these companies over time. So we covered operational factors, operational targets, et cetera. The concept of resilience, portfolio resilience, which we were delighted to see picked up by the TCFD, how incentives and R&D and other factors play into that resilience, because a lot of these companies do actually turn over their portfolio of assets relatively quickly. I think for the oil and gas majors, it's about every dozen years. And then also critically, how the companies interact with public policy. Are they advocating for the transition we need? And linking back to what Edward said, are they factoring in what their trade associations are doing as well? And we were delighted that the resolutions got board backing at the UK-listed oil and gas majors and the mining companies the following year, which of course meant they went through with greater than 90% votes. But we are still seeing the follow-through in terms of reporting and momentum in terms of what the companies are doing. So at the end of November, Shell actually announced a net carbon footprint target for its energy products, aiming to halve that by 2050 with an interim target of a 20% cut by 2035. And then very similarly to the Paris Agreement, they will be ratcheting that every 5 years. So a supply company indicating to policymakers that if they're seeing the shifts in policy and shifts in demand, then they can make more aggressive target setting. And as we speak today, we're expecting a report from BP in the middle of April outlining their latest thinking in this area. And in fact, that will be the first standalone report on climate change from BP.
That sounds very interesting, and congratulations on all this hard work. So I'd like to move from talking about proposals that were board supported to talking about proposals that were not, namely the proposal at Exxon last year that was really kind of an attention-grabbing proposal, and like we kind of said, a really watershed moment when it came to these types of proposals and, shareholder support for these types of proposals. I'm curious. I'd like to turn it over to Edward and to Pat to talk a little bit about, going up to that vote, what you were anticipating, and also to talk a bit about Exxon's response. I know that they've recently put out a report that was in direct response to this proposal. So I'm curious about your thoughts on that reporting, whether they have upheld, the ask of the resolution, and what your kind of thoughts on that whole situation are. So maybe, Pat, I will start with you.
Okay, thank you very much. Early this February, when Exxon released its 2 degrees Paris scenario report, we welcomed it as the most complete disclosure on climate change impacts from the company to date, and since it offers a baseline for ongoing shareholder engagement. That having been said, we felt the report had too many generalizations and too few specifics as to how Exxon plans to participate in a low carbon economy. We felt it relied too much on optimistic assumptions of undiminished growth in fossil fuel demand. And further, the company has still not yet presented a detailed analysis to investors as to how its own portfolio performs under a 2 degree scenario. Performing a proper analysis would critically inform their business strategy, or should, and going forward, we have already discussed the report with Exxon officials, and we will be submitting a number of questions to the company for further information and clarification. We're going to continue to push it and others to decarbonize, and happily we are continuing to invoke support from a large majority of Exxon shareholders that joined us to support the 2017 proposal.
Mm-hmm. Great. And Edward, I'm curious if you would share your thoughts on the report and Exxon's responsiveness to this issue.
Yeah, absolutely. I think sort of Helen's story of what we've seen happen at BP, Shell, and the UK listed mining companies really illustrates well how these votes matter and the difference they make, and the difference they make sort of over time as well. So I'd just like to kind of thank everyone that that voted for the Exxon resolution last year and sort of created this this watershed moment. I mean, I think my reactions to the report are pretty similar to Pat's, as you'd expect. Our perspective is that Exxon took the shareholder vote extremely seriously and responsibly, and they announced in December last year that they would be acting on the resolution and then issued their report in February. I would definitely agree with Pat that the report represents a significant step forward in Exxon's climate disclosure and its engagement with the issue of climate change. But I'd also agree that it's not the finished article, and there are a number of improvements that we would like to see, both in terms of the company's disclosure and its strategy on climate. Some of the things I would highlight, like Pat, I think there's detail missing. There's sort of sensitivity analysis included on certain issues like electric vehicles and renewable power, but not others like, key demand areas for oil like commercial transportation and chemicals. There was a lack of detail on where stranded asset risk lies within the business, although that sort of stranded asset risk was acknowledged for the first time. And I think, we'd like to see more detail on sort of the board oversight of climate risk, linkage between sort of executive remuneration and climate change, which was sort of covered pretty thinly in the report. So, our overall reaction is that you know, Exxon took this seriously. They've produced, as Pat said, the best report on climate, the most detailed and the most kind of serious engagement with the issue that they have done to date. There's more work to be done. I think exactly as you would expect. You wouldn't expect the perfect result in year one. I think in particular, we're looking for the company to move to a fully TCFD compliant reporting format. And then we're also looking for progress towards, you know, where Shell has got to, as Helen was saying, in terms of setting targets and giving a future direction for the business so that investors can be reassured that there is a resilient strategy there for the business. And I'm very excited about Climate Action 100 Plus and this being the vehicle through which this engagement will be taken forward in the future.
Absolutely. Well, you've transitioned me wonderfully. I was hoping to talk a little bit more about the Climate Action 100 Plus. And could you give us some details about what this is and how you guys are kind of looking at this issue through the lens of the Climate Action 100 Plus?
Yeah, thank you very much for all those comments from others who are speaking on this call. I really do want to emphasize the point that Helen made, which is that we began some years ago to understand the importance of this issue, and slowly but surely, I think we've built a common approach in the investor community and one that's growing. I do want to highlight that at Exxon, there were some other very important shareholder votes before we came to climate risk reporting. Most recently, proxy access, which gives shareholders the ability, if they have 3% of the shares and have held them for 3 years, to put forward candidates to the board as alternatives to the management slate. And a few years prior to that, a vote was narrowly won, but it was won, to bring in majority voting, which gives shareholders the ability to vote against the board. Now, I say that because often when we're looking at how these issues work in the United States, it's easy to forget how recent it is that shareholders have had those rights. And in Europe and in other markets, it's taken for granted that the board is directly accountable to share owners. But that's had to be argued, negotiated, and campaigned for in the United States. But I think it sets the stage for a conversation between shareholders and the board. Without that sense of accountability, it's very difficult to make progress on all sorts of different issues. And climate risk reporting is one example. So I also want to call out a new development at Exxon, which was very important, which is that Exxon has also decided to retire its policy of preventing the board talking directly to share owners. We've been appreciative over the years of the ability to discuss with the senior management team all these important topics. But at the end of the day, we cast our votes for the board. So opening up that channel for dialogue is really important. And we would applaud Exxon for coming in line with what I think is now common practice, even in the United States. On Climate Action 100 Plus, what we've done is work with regional networks. Helen mentioned the European network, but Ceres in North America, the Asian network on climate change, and also the Australian and New Zealand network, plus the PRI, Principles for Responsible Investment, which is a global network, as I'm sure many of you know. The purpose of bringing us working together to bring these networks into an engagement strategy was really to build on the common voice that we found when we were engaging policymakers around the Paris Agreement. There was a promise in a statement that was made in Paris that we would be all working together to follow up on what the Paris Agreement was calling for, but we didn't have the infrastructure. We didn't have an organization or a set of objectives agreed and a way of working. And that's what we're building at the moment. I'm glad to say that the idea was launched with a call for investors to participate at PRI in person in Berlin late last year, and then formally launched at the Paris One Planet Summit, at which point we were able to do two things. One, announced that we had $27 trillion in investor assets signed up for the initiative. So that is, I think, the largest coordinated shareholder project that we've all been able to bring forward together. And the second thing we were able to announce at the Paris Summit at the end of last year was a list of 100 companies. And this 100 company list, we've said 100 plus because we know it's not the end, it's the start. But these 100 companies we have called systemically important carbon emitters. This is not a name and shame list. This is a list of companies whose current emissions are critical. The bringing down those emissions is going to be necessary in order to meet the Paris targets. And I think what we've all found through doing carbon footprinting is that a relatively small number of companies are responsible for a very large slice of emissions. We found in CalPERS less than 100 represented well over half. So what we've done in identifying this list of 100 is look at their what are known as scope 1, scope 2, and scope 3 emissions. So it includes companies just through that methodology. They're more or less evenly divided between companies in North America, Europe, and Asia, including Australia and New Zealand. That is just the way it all fell out from the methodology, about a third, a third, a third. So that has set the stage for this global network to begin to identify lead investors who can build on current engagement and take it further. And critically, this Climate Action 100 Plus initiative has agreed on three areas that we're going to ask companies to respond to. One is on governance. You would expect, as Edward said, making sure that the directors have the skills and experience and are fulfilling their responsibilities for overseeing this risk and oversight of the opportunities. Secondly, to set targets. The Paris Agreement overall, as you all are aware, will require something like an 80%, that's 80% reduction in emissions, and we'll only achieve that if the companies that are responsible for the emissions do their part to develop robust, resilient strategies which keep them in business, keep them financially successful for us as investors, but also achieve those emissions reductions. So the second request is very specific about reductions in emissions. And the third area is to back the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosure, the TCFD. So we want to deck that $27 trillion against the recommendations of the TCFD. Now, we are adding a couple of extra elements of consideration. I think the example of Rio Tinto is a good one in that we want to make sure that what companies are doing on lobbying and public policy and work through trade associations, where they're using share owner funds, we want to make sure that that lobbying and policy advocacy completely lines up with corporate strategy. And for that, we need full disclosure. So we've added that piece in as an additional request alongside the TCFD framework. And also, as I think has been mentioned by others, we want to ensure that compensation or remuneration, as it's called in Europe, is decked, aligned with the strategy on climate change transition that the company develops. You know, we do still have some chief executives being rewarded for increasing proven reserves, which, of course, is a fossil fuel concept. And arguably, if they were rewarded for, building up BTUs or British thermal units, which are neutral, it could be renewable energy, it could be a range of other sources, that would count as success with this type of transition strategy in mind. So, if there's interest with others on this call, please do go to the good old World Wide Web and type in Climate Action 100 Plus. And you'll find that we have a website which sets out the governing structure, the objectives, the list of the companies, the list of the signatories, and we'd welcome you getting involved, either as a lead investor or in a supporting capacity. Both of those options are available. I think my final point I'd like to make is that we would also want to, I think, in this proxy season, see a more positive response from the investor community supporting these 2 degrees proposals. We know that management support in Europe was critical to giving investors comfort that climate risk reporting was needed. And in the United States, it's more uncomfortable because management has typically protested and said no, and we do not need these share owner proposals. So that means it's a much tougher decision because the investors have to say, well, actually, okay, we get that board of directors, but we're the long-term owners with responsibilities that far outlive, you know, the tenure of individuals on the board. We've got to be looking for, you know, decades ahead for this company's success. So I think we really want to engage with those investors who have voted against these proposals in the United States, but looking at the record, voted for them in Europe. And given that this is a global industry, that does not look coherent. It's flawed logic to think climate change will be relevant in one place and not in another. It's a global agenda. So thank you again. I think that's plenty to have covered on Climate Action Podcast, and we hope others will join.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. I have just a couple of questions after going over that. You know, you talk about governance a lot, and you also mentioned climate-competent boards. I'm curious how you guys are assessing whether boards are climate-competent or not. What kind of disclosures are you looking for? Are you looking for specific skill sets, or how are you guys looking at that issue?
Yeah, thank you. It's a great question. And I would say that this question about the board's competence is not just a topic on climate change. It is a live conversation looking at technology, looking at cybersecurity, looking at globalization, looking at changing demographics in companies' markets. So from the CalPERS point of view, our focus is board quality. And we say there are three elements to that. One, you need boards that are independent. That makes complete sense. And I think the investor community has developed some good understanding of the importance of independence. Competence, that was really something which came to the fore in the wake of the financial crisis, when we were looking at the boards of banks and finding that people were sitting on risk committees with no experience or qualifications, professional qualifications even, around financial risk and oversight. And things went badly wrong. So the question of competence, I just want to say this is fundamental to all boards. Do you have, as the board articulated, a strategy, and then set out clearly what are the skills and experience that are going to enable the board to oversee management's delivery of that strategy? And thirdly, diversity. So one of the things in the United States that we see is that boards are typically more long tenured, directors are older, and less diverse. The boards are just less diverse, and we have, you know, given testimony and evidence on this on more than one occasion, and glad to share the analysis. But what this means is that we have boards which need refreshment. So the board succession planning, the board refreshment is critical, but we need the disclosure from the companies to set out, it's the board's responsibility to do this. This is not a job for share owners to be wagging our fingers at boards. The boards must be able to articulate how the skills and experience on that board actually map to the strategy that's been articulated. And we and other investors on this call have been part of this, have petitioned the SEC in the United States, calling for disclosure on diversity, but in a matrix format, where you can map skills and experience, including gender, including other dimensions of diversity, such as race and ethnicity, but not exclusively. These are just obvious examples, and show how you've got a board which has got, is freshened up and ready for the challenges ahead. And on that, I would back to Exxon, the company we've been talking about. Exxon responded, I think, to this. You know, there'd been some discussion about why there was nobody on the board with any background in the industry. You know, people with great accomplishments in all sorts of other industries, but how would that position the board to be able to oversee management in the energy sector when there was nobody there with that kind of background or experience? Now, the company was concerned about conflicts of interest with people with industry experience, and we know that's something you have to manage, but notable that they appointed a climate scientist, and several other boards have found ways to improve what we would think of as climate competence at BHP by having a climate scientist advising the board, and likewise at Shell. So I think we've got to allow companies how to address.
So can I just interject for a moment? We now have a proposal before Chevron asking that company to appoint a director with environmental expertise, scientific expertise, onto the board, so that when management comes forward with proposals that may have serious environmental impacts, there should at least be one independent director with scientific expertise to be able to ask the right questions. And especially in the extractive industries, I mean, we feel this is a must, and we'd like to encourage people to vote for our Chevron proposal. And I agree that Exxon, this is an area where Exxon actually moved forward. We are waiting for Chevron to do the same.
Great. Thanks, Pat. And any final comments on climate competent boards or what you guys are looking for in the coming proxy season when you're evaluating the board?
Yeah, I think most of what we're looking for can be summed up as good governance. We need boards that are accountable, that have the expertise, and as Pat says, expertise on this climate change transition, our understanding of that is changing. But so is it on issues like cybersecurity, geopolitical risk. In other words, I think we're moving away from a generation of directors where this would be the pinnacle appointment of your career. We're moving from that into an understanding that directors are among the most significant people in the world economy because of their responsibilities for overseeing corporate strategy. And that is much more demanding. So I think we've got to put the burden of proof on the boards for them to articulate who they have on the board, what their skills are, and how they're relevant to the company's strategy. And that's true for all sectors. And, thank you to New York State for filing at Chevron. I think this is going to be an important issue as we move forward.
Absolutely. I know board composition is definitely front of mind for most companies and most investors these days. So it seems like a natural extension to be looking at climate competency as well and how that plays into the board composition. So, Pat, I know you mentioned the Chevron proposal, but what other proposals do you have coming up this year, and what proposals are you really focused on for the 2018 proxy season?
Well, I mean, coming off the last season and the success at ExxonMobil, we had actually last year filed a number of proposals on two-degree scenario that did not do as well as ExxonMobil, but got very high votes in the 40% area. So we found subsequently after refiling that there's now been a ripple effect from the Exxon vote. So for example, we had refiled with Duke Energy, Dominion Energy, and DTE Energy, where we, all of our resolutions were asking the same resolution, asking for a two-degree scenario analysis. They received in the mid to high 40s. All of those companies have now agreed to undertake that analysis and issue the reports. In fact, Duke Energy just came out with theirs just this week, which we'll be taking a look at. So we're very encouraged. As I said, there's a tremendous ripple effect from the Exxon vote. Also, we have several additional resolutions on the topic that are coming up for votes. Chesapeake Energy, Great Plains Energy, SCANA. We have a resolution to Southwestern Energy that we're having some very good discussions about this with the company, and we may be withdrawing that with an agreement sometime very soon. We're also planning to file with Westar next month. So we're quite active. We're also going to be supporting the low carbon transition resolution at ExxonMobil that, as you so has put forward, we think this is an appropriate next step for the company in terms of their analysis. And so we will be supporting that resolution as well.
Great, thank you. And have you had any successes this year as far as, you know, withdrawing proposals or any proposals that didn't even need to be withdrawn? You know, maybe you got them to report through an engagement or something along those lines.
Well, I mean, as I mentioned, the highlights were the Duke Energy, Dominion Energy, and DT Energy, which after, subsequent to refiling those resolutions, all of those companies ended up coming to us and saying, look, you know, we're not going to do this. And because, I mean, once again, the handwriting is on the wall, and the ExxonMobil vote was really historic.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I'd like to turn it over to the panelists to see if anybody has any concluding remarks or anything that they'd really like for people to watch out for in the coming months or keep in mind when they're voting their proxies.
Yeah, it's Anne. I have one final comment. I'd like to share something which was said to me last year by one of the directors on the boards. One of the companies where the vote was won. And before the vote, this person said to me, you know, we've said to management, it's time to get onto this. We've got to do more. We need to report. And management's response was, well, if investors cared about this, we'd hear about it. And of course, a big channel for companies to hear from investors is through their earnings call. You know, their quarterly earnings call. And that tends to be the loud, the noisy side of it. But of course, it's typically the very short-term end of the shareholder register. It's more the traders than the owners talking. So the value of a vote is sending this signal to the board that investors regard this as something important. And typically, we are not the people on quarterly earnings call, because we're long-term. So I would say it is an invaluable opportunity. And I know that this director was essentially saying to me, get the vote out, and then I can take this back to the board and we can start moving. But we can't do it without that voice from the voting. So I think understanding how constructive it is to actually send that signal is really very important.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for that anecdote, Anna. And definitely voting is very, very important. So thank you so much to Patrick, Anne, Helen, and Edward for participating in the call. And also thank you so much to Laura and to the staff at Ceres for helping us to organize this call. We appreciate all of you taking the time to speak to us about this during what must be a very, very busy time of year for you. If you would like a link to the audio or would like to view our show notes, please go to our website at www.glasslewis.com, and you can access the call on the Glass Lewis blog. For more information, please email proxytalk@glasslewis.com. If there's ever an annual or special meeting coming up that you think warrants special attention and would merit some discussion with your colleagues, please don't hesitate to email us. Also, if you have comments about Proxy Talk that you wish to share with us, your feedback is always very, very much appreciated and will be taken into account as we structure our future calls. Have a great day, everyone. Thank you.
This recording should not be considered a solicitation of proxies by Glass Lewis. Glass Lewis has not sought permission to do so from the SEC, nor will it. This recording is for information purposes only and should not be construed as providing investment advice. In addition, Glass Lewis makes no representation regarding the accuracy, completeness, or reliability of any statement of any of our speakers in this recording. If you have any questions, please contact us via our website, www.glasslewis.com.